page 972, where we'll be starting. If you want to borrow a Bible, you're welcome to just indicate and one will come round. Although lots of what we will cover, because we're going to look around the Sermon on the Mount, will come on the screen, so don't worry if you haven't got one. Well, as Andy said, we've been looking at the Sermon on the Mount. I don't know how long it is, several weeks, is it? Months? It's been a while anyway. It's an important part of the Bible, an important part of Jesus' teaching. And actually, in many ways, it's perhaps the best known kind of bit of Jesus' teaching. Many people will talk about. I don't quite want that yet, I don't think. But anyway, I'll leave it there. Many people will say this is actually the best bit, or this is the bit that's made the most impact on people's lives. Perhaps the most influential, although being influential depends upon people doing something about it, which brings us to where we were last week. If you want to find out some quotes on the Sermon on the Mount, there are thousands of them. It may be the most referred to piece of the New Testament. All kinds of people refer back to it. Just one. Here's somebody who said this: "I do not believe, quote, there is a problem in this country or the world today which could not be settled if approached through the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount." Who said that? President Truman, Harry S. Truman, President of the United States. So he presumably knew a little bit about, you know, fixing or trying to deal with problems in countries and in the world. That's what he said about the Sermon on the Mount. And we have been looking at it under this general title, Baggage Check. The idea being that Jesus' teaching on the Sermon on the Mount gives us a way of just checking out what we're carrying with us. Are we taking too much on our journey? How does our life shape up with this standard that Jesus sets? It's very powerful stuff. And as we see in chapter 7, verse 28, on page 972, when Jesus had finished these things, saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. It was different. Interesting, verse 28, when Jesus finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed. Whereas in verse 1 of chapter 5, we read, when he saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down, and his disciples came to him. So it was initially the disciples, the crowds have kind of gathered round. And so they too are amazed. Why are they amazed? Well, because of the way Jesus has been teaching them. Their scribes, their teachers, always referred to somebody else or the law of God. Jesus was different because he'd been teaching with authority. He'd been standing there and saying, this is what I say to you. And it was different. It was unusual. In fact, at certain times in the Sermon on the Mount, he even added to what had already been said. He said, remember, there's a whole series of phrases where you have heard that it was said, but I say this. So in that kind of a phrase he's saying, he's got more authority than anyone else. And it comes through. As Andy said, it was like the X Factor. I like the idea of them spontaneously bursting into applause, whether they did that kind of thing in their culture or whether it was just a kind of murmur positively or whatever it was. But there was some way in which they expressed their amazement. Now, perhaps they were amazed by the pictures Jesus used, especially the last one. We saw it last week. There it is, up on the screen. That was the final punchline to the whole talk. Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house. Yet it did not fall, because it had its foundation on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash. Amazing teaching. What is Jesus saying? Remember last week? What does this actually boil down to? What is it all about? Well, what he's saying is quite simply this, isn't it? Hearing and doing what I say is like building on the rock. Hearing and not doing what I say is like building on the sand. That was what we saw last week. Now, when you think about it, it's a very striking picture, isn't it? It's a very powerful piece of teaching, but what kind of claim is this? Isn't this just a little bit arrogant, perhaps? But there it is, right at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus Christ speaking quite clearly, saying, if you do what I say, your life is safe. If you don't do what I say, it's destruction and collapse that you're heading for ultimately. And Jesus made these kind of claims, didn't he? He claimed to be the way. He claimed to be the truth. He claimed to be the life. He claimed to be the light of the world, the judge of the world, the expected Messiah. He said that he spoke the words of God. He said he did the things that God was doing. He actually claims to be God. At his trial, the high priest says, are you the Son of God? He says, yes, that's as you have said. And you will see the Son of Man coming in clouds of great heaven. These are amazing claims. That's why they wanted to kill him. But that wasn't all he did. There were his miracles as well. Many different people were healed by Jesus on many occasions. There were lots of critical literature going around in the first and second century, stuff that criticized Christianity. None of the critics ever claimed that the miracles didn't happen. Always they criticized the miracles because they said it was an evil power that was at work when Jesus did those miracles. Nobody denied them. Why did nobody deny them? Well, they all had parents and grandparents. You know, there were too many people around who could remember what Jesus had done. And then there was his teaching, the greatest ever, attested by many people who are not Christians, people who are great thinkers, writers. Today, those who are against Christianity will admit that Jesus' teaching is amazing, just as these people said, just as President Truman said. I don't know whether he was a believer, but he saw the significance, the authority of Jesus' teaching. And there is Jesus' character. They're amazed by him. He is an attractive person. He was then, he is now. Many people who are not in church today will be impressed by Jesus Christ. There's a whole group of people, according to the researchers, who are going around saying, Jesus I love, the church I hate. And one of the challenges for us as believers in churches is to see how can we introduce these people who are attracted by Jesus but put off by church to come and be part of the body of Jesus, which happens to be the church, not the building, but the people. His enemies could find no fault in him. On one occasion he said to them, which of you accuses me of sin? They couldn't find anything. His friends, Peter, who was with him every day, on the road, having breakfast, getting up, walking all day, getting cross. He said there was no sin in Jesus. And then, of course, there's his death and his resurrection. Both very unique, to put it mildly. The resurrection, no body. A whole pile of evidence that suggests that the most likely thing that happened is that Jesus did indeed raise from the dead. But we haven't got time to go into it just now, but you can check that out for yourself. And then the impact Jesus has made. All these different things then. Let's look at something else. Let's look at this formula. His claims, his miracles, his teaching, his character, his death, his resurrection, and his impact. Put all those together. What do we make of him? Who is he? Is he crazy? Is he evil? Or is he who he claimed to be? Jesus, he's amazing. Think about it. C.S. Lewis said, maybe it was he who first suggested these three alternatives. He's either mad, he's bad, or he's God. He can't be, he's either one of those things. Which do you think? maybe something you can share with friends or think over for yourself. Maybe we need to be, if you're interested, to be involved in an Alpha course or another kind of course like that, if you'd like to be part of one. Either ask us afterwards, or if you're listening on the web, then get in touch with the church office here or find a church in your locality where you could examine these things for yourself. So Jesus is amazing. Amazing teaching, amazing claims, amazing miracles, amazing character, amazing events, amazing death, amazing resurrection, amazing impact. But this crowd had just heard his teaching and were amazed by it. And then there was this challenge then, wasn't there? Hearing and doing. Are you going to do what Jesus says as well as hear it? If so, your life is built on the rock. If you don't do what Jesus says, then your life is built on the sand. So here's the question then. What did Jesus actually say? I wanted to go back over some highlights in the Sermon on the Mount and pick out some of the general kind of themes and remind ourselves of what Jesus is saying. What is so amazing about Jesus' teaching? As we look back on the Sermon on the Mount, what is it exactly that is so extraordinary? And I want us to think about three things. First of all, I wanted to think about Jesus' take on the world that we're part of. Secondly, to think about Jesus' take on the people that we are. Thirdly, Jesus' take on the difference we can know. And fourthly, Jesus' take on the way it works out. Let's start then with the first one. Jesus' take on the world that we're part of. Just to remind you of some things he said. This is how the Sermon on the Mount starts. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Matthew chapter 5, how it all begins. Jesus is real about the world. And what does he say about the world? It's a mess. People are hurting. People are empty. People are wrung out. People are longing to see righteousness done because it isn't being done. People are being persecuted. That's where the sermon starts. Jesus is real about the state that we're in, about the world that we're part of. And this is the world Jesus comes into, and he meets this world head on. He experiences what it's really like. And his message is that God has done something in this messed up world, that God is passionate about this world and people who are hurting in this world, that God has come into this world, the world that is described in Matthew chapter 5. He's actually coming. I was visiting a place in Pakistan a few years ago called Gujranwala. It doesn't sound very attractive, does it? Gujranwala? No apologies to you if you're from there, or even chances are you may even be listening from there, thanks to the web. But it's not the best town in Pakistan. And I was visiting it with visiting one of my friends there who worked there, and we were walking down the road by a college, and he said, I came down this road and I just exploded with anger. I was absolutely furious. I said, what was that, Mike? He said, well, you see, we're walking, it's a very dusty place. He said, there were people here washing the trees because the trees were all dusty, and there were guys out there kind of hosing down the trees. The road's quite nice there, the only nice bit of road in the area. He said, and the reason is because there was a member of the government visiting the college at the end of the road, and so they washed the trees so that the place looked good for the cabinet minister when he arrived. And he said, I was absolutely furious. In fact, I went up to one of the guys washing the trees and said something, although I felt bad about it because it wasn't his fault. He was just washing the tree. Because he was saying, look, this town has got huge challenges. There are people who are dirt poor. There are issues of injustice and so on. And all you can do is wash the tree when the cabinet minister arrives. Jesus came into the world not like the cabinet minister visiting the college. The trees weren't washed for him. As we'll think at Christmas, he got born into poverty, into oppression, into homelessness, into being caught up in the vagaries of a foreign power who move people around as if they're pawns on a chessboard. That's what Jesus came into. He experienced it as it really is. But Jesus also knew that it could be different. Look at some more teaching from the Sermon on the Mount. He tells his disciples, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Let your light shine before men, it says, so that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. It can be different, says Jesus. That's what my colleague was doing in that town in Gudrun Waller, being salt, being light. That's what he calls us to do, to make a difference in this particular world. Because the point is that God is able to work through broken people, through hungry people, through meek people, through people who are being persecuted. That actually that's where God's blessing, bizarrely, can be experienced. In the broken bits of our lives. That's what blessed are the is partly about, isn't it? God's power, God's presence is seen right in the heart of life as it is. Life as we know it, to use that old Star Trek phrase. That's where his blessing is. That's where the power of his presence is seen. That's Jesus' take on the world. Will we listen? Will we do it? Will we see that as followers of Christ, as Christ followers, then we need to be equally realistic about life as it is and be engaged in making a difference, not pretending that these things happen to other people and not to people who are part of our church, because actually they are happening to people that are part of our church and maybe to us right now. So that's Jesus' take on the world that we're in. Are we going to listen to it? Are we going to do it? What else does he say? Let's think secondly about Jesus' take on the people that we are. We have to live in the world as it is, don't we? How do we bring order out of chaos in the world? How do human beings do that? Well, they do it usually by a couple of things. Religion and laws. And the Jews of Jesus' day were like Muslims today. The religion and the laws were kind of connected together. And Jesus takes a close look at some of these religious practices and laws in the Sermon on the Mount. And he zeroes in on murder and adultery, amongst other things. And if you look at Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 to 30, he uses very extreme language, but he makes the point. Here it is. He says, you have heard that it was said, do not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And he says something very similar about murder. What's he saying? He's saying that the problem is in us, in his heart, says Jesus. The man who's lustfully looking at the woman is committed adultery in his heart. The man or the woman who hates their brother or sister is committing murder in their heart. Where's the problem? In the heart. That's the real problem. The real problem is in us. I knew some people once who lived in London. They don't now, but they did then. They lived in a house that was made into flats. It was along Stockwell Road. In South London. It's a long time ago. And while they lived there, they lived in an upstairs flat. It was an old house, a bit like some of the bigger houses around here. Ground floor flat and upstairs flat. While they were there, somebody visiting the house below was murdered. And it was obviously a very traumatic time. And their vicar came round to visit them. It's quite a high-profile, kind of shocking case. Perhaps, sadly, it was a bit rarer then than it is now. The vicar was visiting them upstairs and came down out of the front door. And the paparazzi, or the local guys, were on the press with their on the doorstep with their cameras, and said to the vicar something like this: "Why? Who do you think might be responsible for this?" And the vicar said, "I am." And paused. He said, "You are. We are. We're all part of it." He made the point that Jesus is making. Where is the problem? It's in us. The famous debate went on in the Times, but forgive me if you've heard this before, all on the subject of what's wrong with the world. One letter came in. "Dear sir, what's wrong with the world? I am. Yours sincerely, G.K. Chesterton." Apparently the shortest letter ever written to the Times. But it makes the point. Jesus, take on the people that we are. It's the problem we have. This is humbling. But it's the first step. Like anyone on the road to recovery, whether it's alcohol abuse or drug abuse or any other kind of problem, we have to admit that we have a problem before we can start towards the answer. Are we going to listen to what Jesus says about the people that we are, the fact that we have this problem, that it needs to be sorted? Or are we going to hear what Jesus says and disregard it? Let's move on. Because the third thing Jesus talks about is the difference we can know. Because as the sermon goes on, beyond chapter 5 and into chapter 6, Jesus begins to show people that there is a way to be different, that it doesn't end with the problem. We can live lives that are different. Some of the most famous verses in the Sermon of the Mount, in chapter 5, verse 38, are these. "You have heard that it was said," says Jesus, "eye for an eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If someone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn from the one who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father in heaven." Remember, we thought about that as we went through the sermon. You see, this is a very different way, isn't it? How is that possible? Well, it has to be worked out from the inside, doesn't it? How can you love your enemy? You can only love your enemy if something's gone on inside of you. Because love is something that has to come from the outside, expressed in attitude, in actions of one kind and another. But Jesus is saying, if you're going to love your enemy, something needs to change within. How is that possible? Well, the key is in that last phrase of that passage in chapter 5. "I tell you, love your enemies so that you may be sons of your Father in heaven," says Jesus. A relationship with God as Father. He points to it time and time and time again in the sermon. Knowing God as your Father. Knowing God as your friend. Your Father and your friend rather than your judge. That's the key to the difference. And Jesus constantly spoke of this possibility in his teaching, that we could know God. He could be our Father. It was the eternal life that he came to bring. As Annie said, it was why Jesus died and rose again, so that we could be in that relationship with God. And that relationship that leads to us making a difference, to our lives being different, to our being changed. As Jesus said right at the end, enabling us to do what we hear him say, not just simply to hear it. So as Jesus goes on with his talk, he starts to show how these people can know God, and how that as they know God, that works out in their lives, their religious lives. And this is all in Matthew chapter 6, verses 1 to 18. These people pray, not for show, but because they know that someone is really listening to them. These people give, and they do so quietly, because they do it to please God. They know him near them. They know his reward. They know his forgiveness. So it's all about God in their lives, God being near to them. And it makes a huge difference. So Jesus is saying that a real relationship with the God who made them is critical to them making the difference that he calls them to make in the world, to be really radical. It's not just knowing about God, it's knowing him personally. So we heard this. Are we people who've just heard it, or are we going to hear it and do it? That's the challenge that Jesus brings. Are we going to build on rock or on sand? And lastly, Jesus' take on working this out in everyday life. Matthew chapter 6, verse 19, right through to chapter 7, verse 14. Jesus doesn't just talk about religious stuff in the Sermon on the Mount. He makes it clear, as I said, that this is for life as it really is. And he hits the most practical subject of all, which of course is money. Look at what he says. Remember, Grishma talked about this, didn't he, when he was here? Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot both serve God. You cannot serve both God and money. But it speaks for itself, isn't it? It's pretty blunt. Jesus is pointing to values, what we give our lives to. And he says there are more valuable things than we can buy, more valuable things than we can count, more valuable, more real things, actually, than we can measure. And that goes right against the culture, doesn't it, that we live in. People don't believe that. Jesus says that is how it is. And he works this out in the area of worrying, as we know. Therefore, he says, I tell you, don't worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than clothes? Your heavenly Father knows that you need them, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. It's all there, isn't it? Things Jesus says. And it's about values, about what matters most. And Jesus is saying that righteousness, that God's priorities, that what he gives us, that these things matter, and they matter more than what we can accumulate or what we can build for ourselves. He's actually telling us, isn't he, to get the spiritual aspect sorted in our lives. And from there, everything else falls into place. Not easily, but there's a priority, he says, about the spiritual side. How do we do that? Well, Jesus makes that very clear too in the sermon. How do we get that sorted? Matthew chapter 7. Ask, and it will be given you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks, receives. He who seeks, finds. And to him who knocks, the door will be open to you. Who do we ask? Twisted, isn't it? Ask our Father. He goes on to say, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who ask him? We ask him. Challenge to us, how much do we ask him? How much do we turn what we hear to make it something we do? Do we ask him about that? It's all about values and choices, isn't it? Values and choices. Jesus calls people to trust him at his word. He calls us to find true value in getting the God thing, as it were, sorted out, and then living differently in the world. That's what he's saying in the Sermon on the Mount. He's saying it makes a huge difference. And that's what we celebrate as God's people. If you haven't ever asked him to receive you into his family, to be your saviour, to turn away from what's wrong, to ask him to give you his power, his life, his forgiveness, his direction, his purpose, to change you on the inside, ask him. He says you will receive. So we have a choice. That's how the sermon ends, isn't it? Do what Jesus says, build on the rock, or don't do what he says and build on the sand. He puts another word picture in here too. And again, it underlines the choice. Towards the end of the sermon, there's these two choices, a choice between two things that keep coming in that last section. And we looked at one of them the other night. And it's a very challenging choice. He says, enter through the narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it. But small is the gate and narrow is the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. It's not the easy way. It's not the popular way. But it is the way that leads to life. And Jesus challenges us to take it, to share it, to live it, to demonstrate it. So, Jesus' take then on the world we're part of, on the people we are, on the difference we can know, and how we work it out in day-by-day life. And I guess our prayer is, isn't it, that we want to be people who live out this sermon. Because it's very practical. It's very challenging. And again, if it's something that you're here thinking, well, I'm not sure whether I'm on the inside of all of this, and I'd like to perhaps be involved in a discussion group or something, well, mention that to Ian or Cora, myself or Andy, and then there'll be an opportunity to get together with others and talk things through. Jesus teaches with authority, and they were amazed at his teaching. Let's not just be amazed, because that crowd that was so amazed at his teaching went on to shout for his death, didn't they? Just 2 or 3 years later. They heard it. They were amazed by it. But most of them didn't do anything about it. A challenge for us is not to be like them, but to be different.